Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
Anything we do now is being recorded and it's public and live, just so you know.
Okay, thanks.
How are you?
Start to be normal now. Good, man. You know, fucking get bored of this quarantine life. But unfortunately, contrary to what seems to be a mainstream perspective now, that doesn't mean that the danger is past.
Wait, do you think that's a mainstream perspective now that, like, there's no danger?
No, I don't think it's – well, yeah. I mean, I think that people are just tired of doing this. And so as a result of being tired of it, they're just deciding that they're not going to anymore.
Yeah, that's – I mean, you're also in – you're also in, like, Nevada, right? Yes? It's okay. Oh, yeah. Tweeting the URL. I mean, today's going to be so loosey-goosey. I mean, I'm already on. If you want to watch it, I don't know what... I mean, it's just youtube.com/jsleeper. It's probably there's a thing that says live now or something like that. But yeah, if anybody wants to ask questions, have them come ask questions in the chat because we're just hanging out today. I just feel like on that note, you know, we'll get into what you were just talking about because Allie was talking about that too. I don't know. This quarantine is definitely people are going crazy and just want to be done with it. I feel like just so behind. I don't know. I feel like I've been doing a lot. Like I've been doing a lot of like little projects and things like that. But like, yeah. For instance, like I don't know what I got up this morning to do. I did some like post things I had to do or whatever. But like I got up to, I still haven't put up Good Bad Brains for like the last 3 weeks. I did this like live stream on Friday. That was kind of a big project and that took a lot of work and that mixed with like other regular work and things like that. You're just like the stack of things. Sometimes it just like, it fills up, right? It fills up with like all these things that I should have done or should be done. And good morning, Rogue. Hello. And then instead of doing those things, I like spent yesterday whittling a spoon.
Yeah. I saw a kit recently on Smoky Mountain Knife Works tried to sell me a spoon whittling kit. Comes with a Band-Aid.
Well, that's, you're gonna need more than one of those. My hands are like, I don't even know if you can tell, but like, it's just like, that's a ripped callus under the skin there. That my thumbs are just straight up.
What's that thumb callus from?
Blisters. This one?
Yeah.
Whittling, baby. This is just a blister. It's not even a callus. It's like blister. Let's see. There's one cut.
Yeah, that's how all calluses start, you know?
It's so fun. Yeah, it's so fun. I don't know. I feel like in a weird way because I don't know if it's because I'm – I don't know. Like the fact that we were stuck in the house made me go like I'm going to just do things. And it's – I don't know. Anytime in my life I was like, I have this project idea. It's going to be like this. Every week and every day we're going to do this. I kind of like fail at it or just don't sustain it. It just sounds like a good idea, you know, but I never really follow through. Like even Good Bad Brain's kind of like that. Like Good Bad Brain's something that like falls on and off and it's like, you know, whatever. And then and then we on quarantine and I'd started this quarantine calisthenics thing. And now I'm like 60 something days into doing that like every day. And it's a very ADD thing, I feel like, because it was a very like I just click go live. Doesn't really take preparation. It's a workout. It's things I would do anyway. I do sure. like a little planning here and there in the week of like programming. But my point is like, I guess like anytime I've like laid plans, they always fucking don't really work out. But if it turns into this sort of impulsive like spur of the moment like. I don't know. It's like they say if there's like even a small fence, people are much more likely to like climb over the, even though they could climb the fence. It's just like, ah, there's a fence to climb. I'm not going to go over the fence.
Yeah.
I feel like tiny barriers to entry. And I've always actually associated this as like, I'm not even trying to shoehorn this. Like if there was like a form I had to fill out online, that would stop me from like ever doing something that I had to do. Cause I'd be like, it's going to be so tedious. I don't know how I'm so bad at forms.
I mean, yeah, there's evidence to show that's the case. I mean, there was, a site that went up on Reddit the other day that was like, it was a tool that allowed you to track senators' stock trades.
Yeah.
And of course, like the servers were overwhelmed within, you know, 10 minutes of it being posted. So they just said, you know, the information's free. You're welcome to like look at it, but our servers are overwhelmed. So you have to make an account, a free account, if you want to get on and look at it. Otherwise, you know, check back in a couple weeks when things have calmed down. And of course, nobody fucking makes an account. So,
right.
You know,
that's what it is. Yeah.
Exactly. Including me, I was like, oh, fuck that. I'll just try back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, but it's weird. So now it's like things that are like dreams I have, like big projects, which actually I'm psyched we did the Karate City thing because it felt like it was a little bit of like going back to big projects that take time and years to like put together, but like never happen. But I keep getting so much done. Like I'm doing all these quarantine calisthenics every day and I'm showing up for that. And I've been much more productive in like day-to-day work, like getting edits done for ologies or things like that. But it's like, I don't know. It's very hard to readjust and not just do things that are in the moment. And I don't know what that's about, but the whittling is kind of that. Like yesterday I just felt like, I don't know. It was the morning I started whittling, I think after we did quarantine calisthenics, so technically it was the afternoon, but it still feels like early to me. And then it was the evening and I was like, that's what I did today. You know, I in that moment, I'm always like, no, you have to, I don't know. I always tell myself like, it's a bit of like a getting an organic actual rhythm, listening to your body that I'm allowed to just go like, no, your body's saying you need to chill. Like it's saying, just do this. Don't, I don't know. My friend had this one thing that they use about for like completing work, where they know that their work rhythm is that they're going to fuck around for like a day or two. Like if they know something's due, a writing they have to do is in a week, they just know that they're not going to get to it. So they commit to the first day or two being like fuck around time. And that like what really like makes us feel bad and anxious is when you're like, I should be working, but I'm not. And then you still don't. And da, da. And that if you just like say, no, okay, this is my rhythm. I'm going to commit to this is not work. I just chill first. That's how I like to do it. I like to have dessert first and then I work. Then you like can compartmentalize much better. Then you actually experience like rest. You actually experience. Like,
yeah.
You
know yeah. I mean, it's like with many things, you know, the kind of secondary emotion of worrying about the primary emotion, you know, focusing on that secondary emotion almost never leads to satisfaction or, you know, towards the issue being resolved because it's not actually the issue, you know?
Yeah.
It's like skiing on the top of the issue. And if you focus on that, you never get to the underlying issue.
I also think that's like a part of a bigger, weird, just like difficulty of being a person where you come very focused on the reactions or the feelings that you're supposed to have instead of just encountering like what you do and then becoming obsessed with like, is it normal? You know, like, am I responding appropriately? Is it normal for me to feel this way or that way? Especially in this whole big weird coronavirus thing still, you know?
Yeah.
Where you're like, yeah. How am I supposed to feel with this weird thing? I don't know. It's like that. I the whole thing, the idea that people are going to like go back to normal or try to is very strange. It's very strange that we're having like a 9/11 every day. And it's like, you know what I mean?
Man. Yeah, there's some just dark takes on it too, you know?
What do you mean?
Well, I just think it's, you know, like pressure and stress does, it often exposes people's kind of like baseline orientations towards things, and we're seeing it, you know?
This sort of like black pill aspect of it, like the people who are
I don't know that metaphor.
Like black pill is like, you know, like red pill is like take the blue pill, take the red pill. Black pill is like death cult. Black pill is just like, we're all shit, I'm shit, who cares, let's fucking,
you know. I don't think it's different than that. It's just like people's, the veneer of like, you know, adjacent to what you were saying before, the veneer of people responding the way they feel they should has just like worn off, and you just are seeing people's kind of true colors, I guess.
Yeah.
It's sort of a mix of seeing true colors and like people defaulting to their lowest level of training, you know, where like you're just seeing, you know, people, you're just seeing people say things like, well, okay. So to return to the kind of, you know, Corona issues, there's the false dichotomy that we either have to stay home and quarantine just and not do anything, or reopen everything. And like, the, you know, those have become just the kind of unsubtle, inaccurate polls.
Right.
And on this side, you have like pussy ass liberals who just want to stay home. And on this side, you have manly Republicans who want to go back to work. And of course, that's all just nonsense. Right. There's like, there is a playbook to reopen. I mean, there are things we have to do. There's a sensible way to do it. But I think on the right extreme, you have people just saying things like, well, people are, you know, people are just going to die and that's it. As if like, that's not something, that's not an important consideration that we should be focusing time and attention on. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I mean by people's true views being exposed, you know,
just that they just don't care.
Yeah, I think, well, it's hard to care about people in the abstract. I mean, we know that. Like, you know, people who say terrible things when they're confronted with someone in pain right in front of them often are better than we would expect, you know? But it's just hard. We're not kind of set up to care about things that we're not immediately confronted with. So the abstract notion of someone you don't know being sick or dying far away is just something difficult for a lot of people to viscerally care about.
Right. Why do you think it's so easy? Well, I don't know if easy is the right word, because like, I would say almost like some people with anxiety. I mean, I feel like abstract notions of other people suffering sometimes are like too present.
Well, I mean, you know, empathy is a trait that's on a normal curve, you know? So I think there are some people who are just going to be a little bit farther to the right and just have more sort of innate empathy. But then, of course, it has to do with, you know, your values, your beliefs, the kind of values and norms that you, that shape your worldview. I mean, how much suffering you've done yourself, you know, like that, cause that builds, you know, that's that Khalil Gibran quote, like you can only fill your well as deep as it's been dug by pain. So I think people who've not experienced pain or suffering have a very hard time, you know, appreciating that in other people.
I've never heard that quote. That's a really good one.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I'm surprised I didn't get choked up saying it. It's like my first time saying it without getting choked up.
Yeah. Khalil Gibran is one of those like fallback to great quotes all the time. I think about the parenting one a lot, that like children are not your children. They're an arrow shot from your bow.
Oh man. Love yeah. That. He was great.
Somebody did ask in the chat, this is, I don't mean to be like so random, whatever.
Yeah.
Vibing, dude. It's fucking Sunday.
Yeah.
One person said, oh yeah, Chris. Yes. I also don't even the guilt. I can't snap. Yeah, whatever. We're all there. Don't worry about that. Somebody asked, what does Nick think about internal family systems therapy? Have you heard of that?
I actually just taught a family therapy course. I'm not super familiar. I don't think that was one of the modalities that we taught. I mean, I'm not sure what internal family systems therapy is like, kind of broad umbrella term, you know, for, I mean, it's like a Salvador Minuchin invent, who is Argentinian, by the way, by birth, way of kind of mapping family dynamics. So trying to understand, you know, subgroups within families, triangles, kind of networks of influence. I think it's good. I mean, it to me lends a lot of very useful kind of tools and concepts for mapping dynamics, right? Because, you know, usually the family will come in and you're like, so what's the problem? And they're like, little Jimmy's like a fucking shit, you know, he's lazy and fucking everything up. And of course, it's not little Jimmy's problem, it's a family systems problem, right? And so understanding how to like recruit the entire family and reframe the problem so that they understand it as a relational problem, a problem within dynamics, is really useful. And family systems like allows us to do that. But, you know, beyond that, when you're looking to change, and then there's some like, let me back up a little. There's some like techniques in family therapy, like enactments, getting the family to like reenact the problem in front of you. I think that stuff is useful. Huh. But, you know, most family therapists now are like syncretic or eclectic. They're going to also use other evidence-based interventions. So me personally, I think family dynamics or family systems therapy is really useful for like conceptualizing problems and presenting it to the family. But when it comes to change work, I fall more on the side of like kind of CBT influenced interventions, just because there's so much evidence
in
support of changing thoughts and behaviors using more kind of CBT style intervention.
I opened this Wikipedia page. Let me see. I don't know if this is the same or different, or I'm just going to. It says internal family systems model is an integrative approach to individual psychotherapy developed by Richard C. Schwartz in the 1980s. It combines systems thinking with the view that the mind is made up of relatively discrete subpersonalities, each with its own viewpoint or qualities. It uses family systems therapy to understand how these collections of subpersonalities are organized. Have you heard of this?
No.
It divides into three types: managers, exiles, and firefighters. You ever heard
yeah.
of
Yeah. Look. So family systems therapy, again, which is the kind of Salvador Minuchin started therapy, for, you know, the substrate for most family interventions. You know, this sound, my immediate take is that when we start talking about like different personalities within people, that can be like a fun way to metaphorically look at what's going on. And if it's helpful for you, that's great. You know?
I mean, yeah, but that is, well, I kind of want to, somebody said in the group, somebody else knows about it. It's basically giving characters to your emotions and pain and allowing it to play out. Super creative and almost psychedelic, like without the medicine. It's wild.
If that is helpful for you and like you're making progress doing that, fucking do it. Yeah, why not?
All right.
My view is always to start with the thing that has the most support in the behavioral health literature and then work your way down. But, you know, fuck it. If you, that's my view and that's what I recommend to people. But if you hit on something that you really like and it's working for you, why change that? You know, enjoy it. Go for it.
Have you heard of something, this just made me think about it. Have you heard of something called like constellation, family constellations therapy or anything like that? Something?
No.
Okay. See, because I'm curious about, that's, I just thought, you know, I did this thing once, this like constellations workshop thing. Oh, what are you doing? Are you live right now? Okay. I mean, now we're doing promo work in the middle of the thing. All right. No, it's fine. You don't have to. It's okay. I feel like we're kind of talking about sort of like vaguely pseudoscience therapies or something like that right now. I don't know if people have questions about it. But like, so I did this workshop. I was in a really bad place in my life. I was just a really bad place in my life. Probably like the worst I was. And my mom was like, all right, you're coming on, you're going to do some work or something like that. So she sent me to some therapy things like in a row. I did like horse therapy. And then she put me in this constellations therapy workshop that she'd done that was cool. So I did this like 2-day workshop and it was very powerful. It was very spooky. Yeah. I think I'm like a theater person, so I'm susceptible to those kinds of things. You know what I mean?
Yes. I mean, look, I think that the thing is, you know, my angle is a little bit different because I am a researcher and I develop and implement interventions. So,
yeah,
you know, it's not as if only things that have been rigorously studied can be effective. Like, that's not true. It's just that we know better whether they are or not. That's all. So, you know, and like from my perspective, I try to, you know, I study things so that we can say, hey, this is a good investment of resources. In a world of limited resources where like agencies, local governments, and larger entities have limited resources, we want to invest in things that have some like strong basis in evidence, because that's all of our money. You know, we want to like spend it on shit that's probably going to be effective. But look, if I could send every veteran who has PTSD, who, you know, hasn't achieved like a good outcome doing, you know, PE at the VA and being on meds, if I could take those people and send them on a motorcycle trip across, you know, Western Africa and then go to equine therapy, I would fucking do that. Cause that sounds like an amazing experience. Anecdotally, people report that those are real programs, by the way, that they have like amazing experiences in those programs. Like, fuck yeah. If you can do that, if you're like, I don't want to do PE in somebody's office, I'm going to sign up for a motorcycle trip across Senegal. Like, fucking do that. That sounds awesome. You know, I just wouldn't recommend that as a first line treatment, because like how many people have done that, you know,
right.
300, you know, and just from like a public health perspective, we're not going to start sending masses of people down to do motorcycle trips in Senegal, even though that might be fucking dope for people. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like that when you hit on something where you're like, I like this, this works to me, kind of speaks my inner language, like, then go for it. You know, you don't listen to some scientist tell you that that's not evidence-based if you're actually getting an outcome that you like. However, if you're going to make a recommendation to someone about where to start, I just think the responsible thing is to start with the highest standard of evidence.
Yes, that's true. That's a very, healthy response and piece of advice that I would expect.
Put it this way though. If I had, you know, if I was seeking treatment for PTSD, I wouldn't want to go get PE in somebody's office. I would want to go on that fucking motorcycle trip.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, somebody said, that's what I was thinking of. They said, I thought of my description of the wolf that lives inside me. Yeah, because I've talked in the past, for me, like, I don't know. Yeah, metaphor and, you know, the demon that lives in my rib cage, or that I feel like I met, those kinds of things, like, really do have me, you know what I mean? Like, make, I was thinking about it, like, there is something in human I was just having a moment of thinking about, like, what is it that makes us create gods? Like, what is it that, like, for, you know, not just gods, but, like, idols? Like, you have to craft a thing.
Terror, Garrett. Terror. Terror and darkness.
Is that, like, the predominant, do people think that? Like, that they need, like, you know what I mean? Like, the no. belief is, because to me, I was just, like, it seems apparent to me that I was, like, the same way I do other woo-woo things. It's like I have this abstract notion that there's something I can't explain, like if it's quantum, whatever, some feeling of connection, an existential thing or whatever. What, it doesn't matter. And that just my three-dimensional brain and self, which is struggling to attach to something else that's very infinite and difficult to describe, has to make these abstract notions something I could hold in my hand. So you have that I can worship or ask questions of or whatever. And so that turns into things.
Yeah. I mean, there seems to be evidence that people have a predisposition towards seeking meaning and connecting events in the world in order to create a narrative that makes sense, because that's efficient for the brain. Once you create that narrative and you can slot things into a certain relational framework, the brain doesn't have to do as much work, you know? So there are like, you know, evolutionary psychologists would argue that there's an evolutionary advantage to kind of this patterning of experience, and that in turn gives rise to like systems that govern that patterning, and that's easy for those systems to take on some kind of divine framework.
Yeah. I mean, Alia, there's an ologies episode, they talked about it once. There was like this, which one was it? What am I thinking of? The metaphor. Ah, never mind. Whatever. I know what it was. It was the sports psychology one. And they were talking, I think they were talking about how many athletes like thank God and have like faith, you know, they, you know, and that there is something to.
Yes.
You have this belief, and that belief is enough. That, you know, and who's to
imagine
say?
If you had the belief that the all-powerful, omniscient, omnipotent creator of all reality,
right,
in its infinite multitudes, is invested in you making your free throws. I mean, imagine that belief. God, what would that feel like?
It's true. This is a really stupid example, but I feel like I always apply like this kind of like sports psychology and things to like video games, and even like the I feel like I learn lessons about like best practices about anything I'm trying to achieve in my life, and like figuring out how to make things happen and do better instead of just blaming whatever I want to make to not, you know, like how can I clean up my side of the street and things like that are all like things in video games. And and one of them is like, there's this game Tarkov that I like to play sometimes, very unforgiving shooter type game. And part of the way you end up playing it, because it's so unforgiving, is very cautious, is very terrified, very like trying not to make sounds because sounds are so important in the game, creeping around. And and yesterday I went to play a round of it, just like, I don't know, they're gonna do a wipe suit, and I feel so unattached, I don't play it that much anymore, so I'll just jump in and wing it for a round, you know. So I put like a good rig together and just like hopped into a raid, and I was playing very fast and loose, and like I wiped a three-man squad by myself, and it was like casually, like barely trying, you know, just because I was being so aggro. And I in particular, like, it's because they were playing the way I usually play. Like, they were so scared, you know, they were like, ugh! And there was a guy like just hiding and waiting, and another guy creeping around. He thought I was going to be there, but I just popped out. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, you have to play this game like Call of Duty. Like, you have to play this game just like as if you have, yes, the power of the creator on your side, and you're supposed to just go without thought. I mean, it's funny because it turns into very samurai stuff. It's like the same as jiu-jitsu, where you're just like, the whole thing about the Hagakure, like commitment to your own death, basically being like, I'm already dead. Now I can commit to action. I'm not trying to preserve anything. And that allows me to react without hesitation. I don't know. It's funny.
Dude, confidence is real. I mean, it's confidence has clear performance implications. Like, you know, if you are confident, you perform, as you know, so much better. to a degree, right? I mean, there's the curve.
To a degree. You can't substitute, like, you can't substitute technique and strength and power and time and all the metaphorical versions of strength and power, just like, you know, education and horsepower and your whatever. You can't substitute that just with confidence. But I remember seeing, there's that show Hard Knocks. It's like about football team training camps and stuff, like preseason. They did it on HBO for a long time. I remember seeing like maybe one of the first seasons a long time ago, because I was living with my buddy and his and he was into it. I was watching it with him, and I just like never really cared about sports, but I was like, damn, this is really interesting. And there's this one moment that always stayed with me where one of the coaches, like one of the like assistant coaches, because you know these teams are just like, they have coaches on coaches. They you know.
I hate football culture. I can't.
It's
watch
awful.
It,
but, it's awful. Yeah. Let's forget all that just for this one piece of this.
Right. Yeah.
I totally agree with
you.
Horrifying stuff. But like, there's this one classroom session, and they're going through all this stuff as they get ready for preseason, and it's like slides on the screen and about stuff or whatever. And they get to this one thing, and it's like, and finally, blah blah blah. He goes, I just remember it being like the last slide is like, finally, important, most important thing, blah blah. And he clicks over, and it just says like swagger, and he goes swagger, and he's like talking about it very clinically, but he was just like, you have to like, you know, be on the field like you belong there. You have to like own. And I was like, damn, that is really true, that there is this sense of, which I've talked to Allie about, like I've thought about in other aspects of my life, like when I was a younger person approaching acting, for instance, like I had a ludicrous confidence that like I would go to these rooms and auditions like that I probably had no business being in, but just felt like I belonged. I was like, yeah, I'm supposed to be here. And that attitude of like a sense of belonging, a sense of not like every audition I come in, I would like empty my pockets. I was like, I don't have stuff in my pockets. I just put it on a table somewhere. Just a sense of swagger, not in like a cockiness, but like a sureness, you know. Really helped. And it kind of like has wavered as I've gotten older, not just there, but like in general. I feel like much more apologetic and much more, and it doesn't feel good, you know.
No, because you're smarter and wiser, but
yeah, I know.
But it's
like
true,
sometimes you miss so it. It's embodied, like, I'll be dumb again.
And it's physical, it's also physical, that feeling.
That swagger feeling?
Yeah.
It is. That's true.
It's like totally physical, I think.
What do you mean? Like, what? Like, tell me more.
The way that I experience it, this is not like my, you know, social scientist mind. This is just like my personal experience. I just feel it physically. Like, even, you know, I don't know if you relate to this as much because you're much better, but like, even when it would be time to roll with people, mm-hmm. and I would just be like, I would just feel in my body the times when I was like, I'm going to submit this person.
Yeah.
I just behave differently, you know, like I feel differently versus like an unknown quantity or somebody who's like a lot bigger than me where, you know,
yes,
I'm like, oh, like
absolutely. It's funny. You really do see it play out in jiu-jitsu a lot. I think it's one of the dangers of rank actually is, cause I've been in other martial arts earlier in my life too. And there's some little questions that came in that I'm going to get to, by the way, in the chat. Thanks. I'm just going off on this cause I think it's interesting. I guess we're talking about sports psychology today, but like, okay. Early, I did some other martial arts that I feel like there's like a cultish thing that happens where you just know this person's better than you. You just know the senior person is a better fighter than you. They know more techniques than you in this kung fu or whatever. And so they beat you every time because you've committed to that knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the risks of jiu-jitsu or just anything with rank where like if you get too respectful of the rank and the belt, then or even at the rank of the belt, it could just be the person that you're just so used to them beating you that you're just like, yeah, this person beats me. That's what they do.
Right.
That, like I fall into that. I have like, I think everybody has their like nemesis. I have like one or two that I feel like have become my demon that I'm like, the thing I need to face. That energy is like the hardest.
I like that.
You know what I mean? Like, and other people who are not my demon, so I have no problem with them, but other people are like, that person's really good. You know what I mean? Which is like a weird thing. To me, the hardest thing for me, which is also just the lamest because it is so like annoying, is humorlessness. Like if somebody just is like, I don't know why. I'm like, oh, you're a Terminator. It's just scary to me. It's like weird or like a kind of, because I think I interpret it as a sort of like simple minded. I don't know. It just feels like I used to be the most scared of kids from like downstate Illinois who were like farm wrestlers who just seemed like, something about them, they just had like no I felt like they would kill me and they wouldn't care. You know what I mean? Like there's a part of them that was just like, they don't care. I don't know.
Yeah. I relate. It's cause they're there for a different reason than I'm there, you know? And I have a hard time relating to that reason.
What do you think their reason is?
Who fucking knows, man? I mean, what? Part of me wants to say deep-seated ego fragility, but that's just off the cuff. I don't know, you know?
That's why you're there, or you think that's why they're there?
I think that's why people who are like, I'm here to kill, are there.
Oh, yeah. You know? No, I agree. Well, it's like, weird. It is weird.
I definitely have an ego about it. Like, I don't like to lose and get submitted, but it's not – I don't – and sometimes I will be like, fuck, why didn't I do this? Like right before I fall asleep, for sure. But like, I don't carry that around. Like, I don't, you know, I learn from it, you know? It doesn't bother me on like a deep, I think it also helps to get older. Like, I'm 37, man. There's like a lot of young guys who are going to kick my ass in the gym.
Totally. You know? Absolutely. At this point, too, I got like very, when somebody like really beats me, especially if they trick me, if they're like, I like that feeling. It's like a weird puzzle. I have a weird tendency to laugh during roles and stuff, and I'm always like, I hope people understand I'm not laughing at them. I'm delighted by they fucking tricked me, they like got me, you know. But yeah, I do think there was like a time I was at a tournament and I was pretty happy. I remember, I don't know, because sometimes it's like the nice thing about doing tournaments or things like that is seeing what your body's natural response actually is, you know what I mean? And like actual fight or flight, and you're just like, I hope I don't get too frozen up and scared. I hope I'm able to just be myself, you know? That's the hope, really, is just if you can just be your sort of normal self in a heightened, that's the goal. But like, I do remember the other, like in one of these things, this other guy having like that very jiu-jitsu scary guy look, you know, like tattoos and kind of like bald head and UFC looky guy, and but he was like jumping around, like he was like
cyborg visage,
that like psyched up kind of, and I remember being like, oh, all right, Like, I was like, that's, he's freaked out. Like, he's got to get this energy out or whatever. And I remember being like, I was tired. I had done this, I had like the flu. It was like really bad. And I was just like, I had the most like strange sensation that came over me of like gratitude of like, I just love jiu-jitsu. I love being here. This is all very funny. Let's go do this. And it wasn't like perfect, you know, like, but it was, it was way better to go in like that and just be like, all right, let's see what happens. Because the other thing is you get in your head, if you get in your head too much about like, I'm screwing up. Oh shit. He got to advance the position. Ugh, you're done. You got to, if you got to just like try to be loose and roll, like, I don't know. Some people are really good at game plans or like they lock down, have like a different tournament style. But anyway, what you said too about the mindset of like, I'm going to submit this person. Sometimes I think about a lot is like sometimes the opposite, like if I'm getting stuck in a submission or something like that and I'm just rolling hard or it's in a tournament, sometimes literally in my brain, even if they're close to like they're going to get this armbar or something like that, inside my brain I just go no. I'm just like literally hear it in my head saying no, and it works. Like it's just this, it's very funny that like for all the technique and all the things that I know, like just getting mad doesn't win fights, like that's just something trained fighters laugh at. It's like damn, sometimes just straight up just denial, just being like nah, is works. Like it just it clicks something over my brain where I'm like, I'm just gonna survive this.
Cerebral it is, you know. It is so cerebral. Oh, well, this kind of, I don't know, I was thinking about like instructors and the cult of personality, but this reminds me, like, if we kind of circle back to what people were asking about initially about like different interventions, and I'm always just also careful about somebody who like develops an intervention that's like theirs, because I think like, to me, that's the cult of the leader, you know? And you can have people who are just good healers. Like, it doesn't fucking really matter what they do. They just, like, the force of their personality and the way they connect with people, they're able to, like, kind of escort people towards more health and well-being. And they're just, it's their own personal kind of bubble of charisma. And, like, it's amazing if you find someone like that, but the thing they develop just may not work for other people. Like, that's why it's so hard to develop intervention, because it has to be something that works when I do it and when you do it and when Joe Blow gets trained in it. Like, that's the special sauce, you know? Right. Otherwise, it's like a skillful healer healing. And, you know, that's awesome, but it's not something that you want to kind of promulgate for everyone.
It is like, that is very like acting stuff too. I like, I'm very anti-acting classes in general, which is a little disingenuous because I was lucky that I got a lot of them in my high school when I was a kid, you know, but like, it's because it's one of those things that I feel like a lot of people who want to teach acting don't, they just want to have a room full of people who are like sycophants. They don't really want, they don't really like love acting or theater or storytelling or anything. They just want like to be a guru. They want to be the one that got you there, you know?
Yeah,
it's such a gross feeling. Somebody, okay, so Rogue actually asked in the chat, it's off topic, but curious what your thoughts are on dealing with a, you know, spouse that doesn't really value mental health, that views therapy as like a waste of money. I think a lot of people encounter these kinds of things, or like family members who just don't get it. Like, why do you got to see it? What, are you going to go to a shrink or something like that?
Talk to your friends.
Huh?
Just talk to your friends.
I was like, oh, interesting. That works. Okay, cool.
No. I don't. Yeah. But people who are. Yeah, man. I mean, look, I think this is when it comes to, this is like a larger, or this is kind of a genre of the question. How do you change the views of people who hold foolish views?
Right.
And, you know, you may not be able to. I think one of the questions I like to start with when I'm confronted by someone like this is to ask, how open are you to changing this view in the face of evidence to the contrary?
Right.
And if you are talking to someone, they're like, oh no, my views are based on evidence, so if you present me with evidence to the contrary, I will change my view. That, you know, that's what, 5% of the population. Most people are like, oh, it doesn't matter. Well, I just, it's my feeling. You know, so if you're talking to somebody who, whose views are not based on evidence, it's just based on their kind of off the cuff emotion, I think it's unlikely that you're going to be able to like have a discussion with them where you present them with evidence and have them change their mind. Yeah. Now you might say something like, well, it helps me, I feel better, And there's a ton of scientific evidence in support of it. So I'm going to keep doing it. I mean, that it may just be that, you know, but just to kind of reiterate, if someone doesn't base their views on evidence and you're trying to present them with evidence to get them to change their view, you're going to be frustrated because that's not how they form their view. Right. They form it based on their off the cuff internal processes. And they may not even know what makes them form their view. They may not even be able to articulate why. They just right. don't like it. And maybe it's because of their own sense of vulnerability and fear. You know, what would it mean? Like sometimes this is a question we ask sometimes is in therapy. If someone seems like just unwilling to entertain an alternative possibility, you ask, well, what's the threat? You know, what would it mean if actually this was true? Like, what? Let's okay, it's not. Let's say it's not true, but just as a mental exercise, what would it mean to you if it was? Like, what's the danger? And that can sometimes help people get at, well, maybe it means they would have to do some work, you know? Maybe it means some another set of beliefs that they hold wouldn't be accurate. You know, maybe right. it means something about their childhood, you know?
That's my instinct is when people have an instinctive negative response to personal work, therapy, whatever. Especially if it's like an interconnected system, like a close relationship in your family or you know something like that, the thing I always project is just they must be concerned about unraveling something, destabilizing a system that they have in place that's like what they got. Like, you know, what will it uncover or will it change our relationship and what I get out of this? You know what I mean? Things like that.
Yeah. I mean, you often hear they're kind of like archetypes of people who are anti-therapy, but like one of them is a mixture of the it's bullshit and you're weak variant,
right?
And then I'm like, well, Medal of Honor recipients talk about going to get therapy, are they weak?
Yeah,
you know, start with an extreme and kind of work your way in.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah,
but
yeah,
I think you gotta ask. I do start with the question like, is this a view that you hold based on evidence? And if so, do you want to have a discussion about
you've got?
Another question sometimes, like, because people get they internalize their views as if their views are who they are, which is very dangerous, you know, because I think your views can change based on what you know rather than being a function of who you are. So another question you can ask to kind of shake that up is, where do you think you got this view or who gave you that perspective? Who transmitted that perspective to you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, which cultural influence transmitted that perspective? Which person transmitted that perspective? Who do you think put that in your mind, that idea?
Right.
You know?
Yes. Ro, thank you for asking the question, by the way. Yeah, because I do think this is a very common – I think that it's hard. It's hard to get people – I mean, we talk a lot about ways to try to find affordable help and stuff like that, you know, but even if you're doing sliding scale or find something – I do think it's a common thing of people being like, what am I going to spend money on that or like, how am I going to invest in – you know what I mean?
I mean, there's a couple things, you know, like it depends on how antagonistic you want to get with people. Usually it's not a good idea to get antagonistic because no one changes their mind from being browbeaten.
Right.
But I think, you know, questions to decouple the individual from their perspective, like, and also to take the heat off of you from defending this, you know, this project. So rather than like, well, this is why I think it's important. It's like, wait a second, who do you think put that idea in your mind? Because now it's up to them to explain that idea, which is actually the to me, that's where the onus is, because there is this enormous volume of evidence in support of.
That's a good little judo kind of thing to do. What? Well, I think money is a factor, which is like part of what we're talking about.
But yeah.
Like,
well, then the other thing about money is I guarantee you can always find something dumber that people are spending their money on.
In that, yes, for sure. Like I always think like one thing I think about a lot these days is how much I used to spend at like bars, and like I can't even figure out how I did it. I mean, I've like, never had money. I've always been bad about like feeling like there was enough, and somehow I figured out how to afford fucking drinking. You know what I mean? Crazy. I don't know how, to be honest. Anyway, there's always something. I do think that's true. I really like what you said about if you can kind of like maintain, I don't know. This is a very like, I don't mean this to sound as manipulative as it is, but like that's sort of like the joke, you know, in the Big Lebowski when Walter's like, calmer than you are. Calmer than you are, dude. You know what I mean? He's like, I'm calm. I'm calm. Calmer than you are. Like, I kind of do feel like if someone's going to be like, it's a waste, doesn't fucking... I think what you said, though, is actually really good. Being like, well, there's a lot of evidence and science and stuff of people that says it works. So why do you think it doesn't? You know, like being like, I don't know. I'm not bothered that you disagree. But why? Is kind of a nice way to think about it. Is don't feel so defensive.
The thing is, it's... again, arguing I don't think is a good idea, but, you know, if you typically, if someone holds a view that is not supported by evidence and you just let them try to explain it to you, it becomes clear quickly that it's not a rational view.
Right. I think the unfortunate, I mean, this is a way bigger impossible question to get into, though, is like, and a big question of our times is, a lot of people hold very irrational views that they'll cling to their whole goddamn life just to like not face whatever trauma they've got.
Yeah, you're not going to change those views probably unless the person is open to changing them. I mean, you just can't change views against the will of the person who holds them. Right. But, you know, people deploy all these rhetorical strategies. And you, as a therapist, you have to learn this because people deploy all these rhetorical strategies like they'll... You know, the ad hominem attack is kind of like the like quintessential one where someone says something, you ask them why they think that, they get frustrated and attack you personally, and then you respond to that defensively, and now they've succeeded in shifting you away from the point, and now you're involved in that. And so you just have to totally like abandon your defensive posture and say, well, you're just an idiot if you think that. You're like, okay, well, we could talk about that, but I just want to get back to the question of why you think this is the case.
Right, right. Yeah, it just put
the but usually when someone goes to the ad hominem attack, they're frustrated. They're so frustrated that they're not capable of staying on the point because somewhere they recognize that this view that I hold is not based in evidence.
Right. What's up, Nathan? By the way, Nathan's here.
Oh shit!
Because what's up, my dudes? Finally, we made one live, which is tight. What's up? It's a good one to join for, I guess. Well, we're a little behind it now, but we were like literally talking a lot of jiu-jitsu and like sports psychology stuff earlier. Someone said, I'm just going to share what they wrote in the chat. Kristen wrote in the chat. I have a lot of, and I know we're getting to the end here, but I have a lot of general past trauma, not just one thing that I can point to that caused PTSD. I have a hard time even knowing how or what triggers it. EDM and things like that won't be a good modality for me. I don't know what EDM is. EDM sounds like electronic.
Probably EMDR.
Oh, EMDR. Yeah, okay. I have trouble reining in the bigness of the trauma and have found it more manageable to tackle how I'm handling it rather than what prompted it. Which is like, to me, kind of seems like the approach that I feel like you tend to talk about more is like, I don't know, to me, this sort of therapy that functions, that isn't about head shrinking and getting on a couch and being like, where did this come from? And instead I'm like, no, how is it affecting you? How would you like to not be affected by it or be affected differently? That kind of a thing is the kind of correct approach.
Yeah,
I mean correct. I don't mean to like say like, you know.
Yeah, well, I think... again, like the kind of the Bible for me of therapy is effectiveness. Like it's the book of effectiveness. So if this approach that this person is articulating is effective for them, then that's exactly what they should be doing. You know, if it's allowing you to live more or less consistent with your values and to achieve your goals and to, you know, have the relationships you want and to work and be functional, then yeah, that's the approach you should be taking.
Which I do feel like is kind of related, at least that understanding of like that your needs, like what functions for you or not is valid. And like it just that's a valid experience to be having. So when somebody does close to you have a discussion of like, why this is a waste, I don't like this thing, is like, well, that's whatever they think doesn't change if you are able to function or not, and being like, all right, well, whatever's going on right now is untenable for me. I want to do this thing. Why is that? You know what I mean? Why is that so? I don't know. I feel like it doesn't, I don't know. I'm trying to get at something maybe like how important it is to be able to validate your own. I think when you're near somebody who has very strong personality and opinions, and maybe you don't have them. Maybe that's part of your, you know, anxiety and things that you're trying to figure out. It's really easy to like be put on the back foot, start fighting their game, start like trying to respond to their issues instead of sticking with your initial thing of like, this is important to me. The point I've got to my life means like, this is currently not tenable anymore. I don't like feeling, I can't live like this anymore. You know, that thing they say about like, that change comes when like the pain of staying the same is worse than the pain of changing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, validating yourself, not just like continuing to live with the pain.
No. And the other thing is that when you are like, if you've been unhealthy, you know, meaning that you don't feel good, you've had, you know, you've not been functional, your kind of ability to be effective in your life has been compromised. When that's going on and you're in a relationship, well, when you start to change, that's going to put stress on that relationship, because even if your partner also wants you to change, the fact of the matter is your relational dynamics are undergoing a shift. And most people are uncomfortable when their relational dynamics are undergoing a shift, even if they didn't like how things were before. Yeah. So it's very common that in treatment, you'll have to tell people, look, this is probably going to cause problems with your partner. If you've been unhealthy and isolating and depressed or suffering from PTSD and not doing certain things or doing certain things another way, and you start to change all that, your partner's going to get uncomfortable, and they may, not on purpose, try to put you back in that role because that's what they become comfortable with, even if they don't enjoy that comfort.
Right.
So you got to just be prepared for that. And that's why it's a good idea, you know, if you're really in a course of therapy where you're going through serious and significant behavioral changes, it's a good idea to have your partner come in.
I will say, and I hope that Allie, you don't mind this, I'm not going to get too divulgy, but I will just say one thing I'm very grateful for is like, Allie and I have been through it. Like, we've been together like almost a decade now, and we've been such like different people throughout it. And change is difficult, and it's difficult to like believe in. It's difficult to approach. Like, the change when it actually is actually quite nice. Once things have changed, I will just say like, I'm really grateful that all these years into knowing each other and always knowing that we loved each other, that like, well, pretty much knowing, there were times it was pretty dicey there where it was like pretty volatile, but that like, I guess I just want to say that there's another side that like, you can get to a place where you've actually changed. Like, you've changed how you react to each other and to your environment. We still struggle with, but like, really, I think help each other with like validating our own feelings, believing our experiences matter, believing like untangling things that we held as beliefs for a long time. Like, I think both of us really believed we were supposed to feel discomfort all the time. Both of us really believed that like our guilt was real and our pain was important, and like that we deserved it, and that maybe that's why we kept creating it in each other's lives, like more chaos, more anxiety. I don't know. And not that we're perfect. Like, we both have, I have obviously my ADHD and my depression stuff. And I think you've said this, but I don't think I've seen anybody with depression who does also have anxiety, you know, Allie's anxiety and our things. It's like, not like we're perfect every day, but it is nice to know that like, hey, it's way better. And you can get to a place where like, you untangle some of those patterns.
You can. And look, I would say, you know, a couple of things. One, relationships just won't work without validation. They are, it's not sufficient, but it's a necessary component of a healthy relationship. So both people just need to get on board with that. And if they don't, it's a problem. I've never seen a relationship function where one person simply cannot validate the other. I mean, good luck. You know, the other thing is sometimes, like, back to this person's question about their partner, you know, sometimes if someone, you got to try a lot of different tactics, right? If someone is just like not willing to be convinced, or it puts them on a defensive posture and they can't relinquish their ego in that setting, sometimes you can try a couple of things. You know, one is like, what do you need to get on board with this? Because it's important to me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, like, I think that's... what do you need to get on board?
Right. I think that is, I really like that. Like, that, look, this is a foregone conclusion. I need this thing. This is a thing that's important to me. So where are you at with that? Like, that's, this is a weird, very extreme example, but I had this like thought experiment with myself a long time ago which I still have, which is like, let's say you love your partner. It's like you love each other. You're in love. You've been together. It's something I never understood when you'd see this in the world. And they come to you one day and go, I love someone else. I fell in love with someone else. Whether they're out of love with you or still love you too, or whatever they say, they just say, I love somebody else. And that hurts. It hurts because you're like, ah, fuck. But in culture and reality and people's in stories, the reaction's always like, no, you don't. It's like, how can that be? You say you love me. I have evidence. I have receipts. You said it to me in a text the other day. It's been years and years of you loving me. So obviously this can't be true. Why have you betrayed me? You know what I mean? Like, you're a liar now, I guess. You know, that kind of a thing. And I always like, I don't know, part of it's led to this other thought of like, once you reach I still fall into it, but we're better at recognizing it. Like once you reach the lawyering phase, where instead of just talking about what the other person says they feel and experience, you start trying to bring up evidence of how that can't be true because of this and that. Like, once you've reached lawyering and you're bringing out your exhibit A, exhibit B, like, you've missed the fucking boat. You're not talking about it anymore. Now you're doing rhetoric.
Totally. But
how important it is, like, I was like, if the thought experiment was like, someone tells me that they love someone else, it's like, I can be sad, I can be in pain, but I can't say that's not true. It's like the cat's out of the bag. That's how you feel. That's real life. Now, and I don't know if this is because of jujitsu, honestly. I credit a lot of like combat sports with a lot of like, let's deal with reality on the ground. Like, yeah. One thing I try to bring back to myself all the time is like, it's hard for me because in real life, I'm defeated by my own patterns and thoughts often. And I think I'm getting better at it. But like in jujitsu, I would never, you know, give up and be like, this isn't fair. The guy's bigger and stronger than me. Fuck this. The same way as if you were like suddenly walking through a ravine and your platoon got ambushed from machine guns on the hill, you'd be like, this isn't fair. They have the high ground. Fuck it. I'm not fighting. Yeah. You'd be like, never. You have to live. And how weird it is that in life, when it becomes metaphorical or emotional, I will just say, this is unfair, so I'm not participating. Or I will try to change the rule, say like, that can't be true, and I'll just deal with the technicalities instead of saying like, no, the reality is you said that you feel this way, and I have to engage with that and face like, well, do I love you as a person? Do I want you to be honest and real, or do I want to live a lot? Like, what is that? And I think maybe for some people, the inventory of their own feelings of that is demanded, the change that is demanded by someone else having a disruptive experience is too much.
You can't Mitch McConnell your emotional context, you know, by saying it's against the rules. It's
much like, more succinct, much more succinct. Yeah, you can't fucking like filibuster, you know, your emotions with someone.
It makes sense because, you know, the primary emotion typically is hurt, and then the secondary emotion is anger, and people are much more comfortable with anger and litigating their anger and denying rather than dealing with their hurt and vulnerability. That's like very uncomfortable. So, you know, the last thing I would say is, you know, one of the questions can be like, are you able to be convinced by evidence? Another one, like another, if no, another one can be like, well, how are you going to get on board with this? And if they're like, well, I'm not. And then the, you know, kind of the third one is like, well, then you and I together as a team have a problem. You know? It's you and me together against this problem, which is whatever it is, you know.
Well, I want to say, I think further, like, sort of thought experiment game theory to me of that is like, I've also is the like the me or the dog thing is like, oh, well, someone who loved me wouldn't make me choose. That, like, you know, like meaning sometimes there's a thing like, okay, so let's say you're in that experience where you're like, I need therapy, I think. I want to try that. And the other person's like, I don't believe in that. That's fake. That doesn't exist. And this might sound harsh, and this is simple, easier said than done, obviously. This is not like, I don't mean to be glib about it. But at least for me, there are things other people can do where you're like, oh, I'm under the assumption that you love me and I love you. And that means you care about me and I care about you. And that's part of our whole thing. That's the reality that I'm living under, those beliefs and that understanding. And if I say I have this need and then you go like, nah, I don't fucking care, or I don't think so, or blah, blah, blah. There's a part of me that's like relieved in a sense. Like, I don't even have to, it hurts, but you get to go, oh, my understanding of the situation was different, mistaken. So, okay, I need to change that. And maybe I don't need to feel so much pain over the fact that you're not supporting me or helping because, like, oh, well, I was mistaken thinking
that you were that person, I guess, which, again, easier said than done, but something to kind of like process, I think, is like if someone's not reacting in a supportive, loving way, maybe they're not that like supportive and loving. And it's, you know, something to face. It's difficult and painful, but in a way, a little bit of a relief. I just want to add one little thing too that I think like bears repeating forever and ever in history is like a personal belief, but I'm hoping that you'll agree with, is this: there is no inherent morality to suffering. That like a lot of shit in our fucking culture, whether it's Catholicism or just Protestant work ethic or generally being an American, like there will be blood, like uncomfortable human being who's angry all the time. Like, you are not good for suffering. Like, work is not inherently valuable because it's hard or because it's uncomfortable. And I think that's really hard for a lot of us to know because we have our toxic shame. We have whatever we were born with or taught.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Making those rules? Who's watching you giving you points? Nobody.
No pain, no gain, baby. Like, that's not even fucking true. Like, yeah, there's a way to deal with suffering that's different, that like you can engage with discomfort in an interesting way or feel like, you know, we did the quarantine calisthenics. There can be a way that pain is pleasant and is a kind of discomfort of change.
Yeah. So,
but that's not the same thing.
Yeah. As suffering being inherently moral in some right. sense. No, I think that's a sick morality, honestly. But so
and
like
very
there's
common, though, like very common, like yeah. very common that people are just like, I'm actually a good person because I'm not a fucking bitch and I just like toughen out every day and I'm in pain every fucking day. Okay, you know what I mean?
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I think the other, you know, so there's like kind of a Buddhist phrase that I'm paraphrasing, which is that pain is unavoidable, but suffering is pain plus non-acceptance. And so, yeah. you know, yeah, you're gonna experience pain. That's just like one of the core processes that organisms experience. And there is value in that as a communication tool, right? To kind of point you away from harmful things and point you towards good things. That's like one just basic function of pain, right? Like move towards pleasure, move away from pain. It's like one of the earliest kind of evolutionary processes. But to just sit in pain for its own sake, I've never seen anyone who derived value from that.
I really love that. I don't know if you said that to me in the past, but like that pain is unavoidable, suffering isn't, is like so fucking good. That like suffering is this other layered experience that we create for ourselves versus just dealing with the discomfort of pain.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the dog, right? Like the dog, which to me is a highly evolved being. Like a dog with cancer can be in pain, but it's not suffering about that.
Right. A dog doesn't fucking know that it lost a leg. A dog is just like, I'm chasing that ball, you know? Anyway, beautiful. All right, that's good. I think we're a little over. I'm gonna stop us for today. Thanks for being here. Are you available? Do you want to do a noon thing today? To do a little meditation thing?
I have
that's okay.
plans to go to Mount Charleston today with my wife.
What is
that?
can't say it without saying the Borat boys. I saw a really stupid tweet. I'm gonna leave everyone with this also brainworm. Someone was like, in 2005 they were at some dumb fucking tweet, they're at like a Halloween karaoke party and someone was dressed as Borat and sang Bon Jovi It's My Life, but saying It's My Wife, and there's no way to unhear or unsee that or unthink of that.
Oh man.
Anyway, yeah. So yeah, what's that? Is that hiking or something?
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, there's like woods there. I don't know. It's late, so we'll probably get turned around by the Forest Service or whatever. I'm sure it's full of people already, but we're gonna try.
There's woods there.
Next week, we'll put in the books for next week.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think we'll probably just do a little meditate. I did like a 15-minute one yesterday. Felt good.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I was getting that, like, you know, approaching the door, you know, like my body kind of lose body sensation. Feels good.
It makes such a difference. Like, I've been like reestablishing my lapsed practice, and even like the 3-4 days a week I've been doing it, like, I really feel a difference.
Yeah. I should make it more regular. All right. Well, see you guys. If you're going to be here, I'll see you at noon for QC. And thanks for being here. I'm going to spend right now. I'm just going to drink some water and then go into putting out episodes from previous weeks. Okay. We're going to fucking drop like a month's worth of these live streams for whoever wants to listen to them. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Nick. Thank you all. I adore you all. I'll see some of you at noon, and the rest of you, have a wonderful week. Self-care. Hydrate. Be well. All right. Thanks for joining us, guys. My Good Bad Brain is a production of Mind Jam Media. I'm a little media company. Thanks to Coda for making this theme song with me. And that's it. MyGoodBadBrain.com. Patreon.com/MyGoodBadBrain. You're the best. Have a good one. Self-care. Hydrate. Be well. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.